Today, we're going to be talking about Hobbes. But before I start on Hobbes, I wanted to go over a couple points that came up last time that I thought in the discussion and also looking on the quiz that I gave, a few people had trouble with. One question a number of people asked last time. You remember I mentioned how Aristotle classified the different kinds of government, and two of the classifications are democracy and polity. So a lot of people, or at least a number of people, were asking, what's the difference between democracy and polity, in that both are, in both of them, it's the majority of the citizens of the polis, the city-state, who are ruling. So what's the difference? And people, at least the people who ask, seem to have a lot of trouble with that. And I was thinking, why would people have trouble with that? And I was thinking, in trying to answer that, it shows the basic difference between ancient political theory, the kind Plato and Aristotle carried on, and modern political theory. By modern, say, we mean political theory, say, beginning with Machiavelli, whom we're not talking about in this course, and Hobbes. There's a basic difference. And how does this come out in trying to answer this question, what difference between democracy and polity, and why people were having trouble with it? Well, supposing you were asked today to classify the different kinds of government, you might list their republics, democracies, or you could say you could have different, it, within a particular kind, you would have systems where the legislature is dominant, or the executive is dominant, or is it a centralized system or a non-centralized system? But however you classified it, you'd be making descriptions of what the system of government was. You'd be trying to describe what are the properties of the system of government. But you wouldn't be at the same time evaluating the system. Say, it wouldn't be a classification of a system of government to say, this is a good system of government, or this is a bad system of government. You might think that systems of government, particular ones, are good or bad, but you wouldn't put that into the classification. And that's just what Aristotle did in the ancient political science. Remember, we talked about Plato and Aristotle. Each one was trying to come up with, say, what does human nature require for justice? They came up with different answers, but they think this is an objective matter of fact, what the nature of justice is. So if you're making classification, whether a system is good or bad is part of the objective data that you're dealing with. So the difference between polity and democracy is, in a polity, it's a good system because the majority is acting for the good of the whole city-state. And in a democracy, the majority is ruling, but it's just acting for what's in the interest of the majority. It's not considering the welfare of anybody. And you see, the reason I think people, or at least some people, are having trouble with this is we wouldn't classify governments that way today. We might just say, well, there's democracies, and some democracies are better than others, but we wouldn't put whether it's a good system right into the classification. That's what Aristotle did, and that's why there's a distinction between polity and democracy, even though in each of them is the majority of citizens who are ruling. Now, the second point came up on the quiz that some people, I was surprised that some people answered the question this way, most people didn't, but there were a significant number who answered this. But you remember last time I mentioned an interpretation of Aristotle that Fred Miller advanced and Roderick Long also holds, that said Aristotle had a doctrine of individual rights. And I mentioned a lot of people don't accept that. So the question was, well, what do the people who don't accept that and say Aristotle didn't have a conception of individual rights, what do they think is true of Aristotle's theory? And the answer I wanted was that they think that the state or the city-state is organic in the sense that people are part of a larger whole, namely the city-state. You get the city, the state is really prior to the individual on this interpretation, just like, say, the parts of the body, like their hand or your arm or your leg, are just part of the body. So on this view of Aristotle, the individuals are just part of the city-state. Of course, the Miller and Long have their own way of dealing with passages where Aristotle says that. But what some people answered was the people who think that Aristotle didn't believe in individual rights hold is that Aristotle was a communist. And that is very definitely not true. A communist is someone who believes that there shouldn't be private property, that everything should be owned in common. And Aristotle, in Book 2 of the Politics, argues very much against that. So that wasn't Aristotle's view. So if you say that Aristotle rejected individual rights, it doesn't make him a communist. So I think it's important to be clear about that. Now, with that said, we can get on to what we're talking about today, Thomas Hobbes. Now, Hobbes was the people we're considering. He was lived the longest. He lived a very long life, 1588 to 1679. Remember, in those days, life expectancy was substantially lower than it is today. We can see, say, in the 18th century, Edmund Burke, the great Irishman who became a member of Parliament in England and was one of the great orators, was writing when he was 68. He said, well, I've had a very long life. So he's 68. He's saying, well, this is a very long life. But Hobbes lived to be 92, which was quite remarkable. And he said that Hobbes, according to John Aubrey, who wrote anecdotes about various people who lived at that time, Hobbes said that he had a nervous disposition all his life because his mother went into labor at the time of the Spanish Armada. You remember, the Spain, which was the great world power at the time, England wasn't in 1588, wasn't a major power. It was a fairly strong nation. It wasn't anything nearly like Spain. So Spain was going to invade. So Hobbes said, well, his mother got very nervous when she went into labor, so that's why he was always nervous. So when Hobbes was growing up, he was trained in what's called the classical humanist tradition, in which when you're studying, say, when you're going to, say, when people go to university, now you go to take various courses, you just pick a major that you're interested in, you'll study that. So in those days, when people studied, when they took advanced studies, they didn't just pick subjects they were interested in study those. Like you might say somebody's majoring in economics or political science or math. People were trained in the classical languages, in Latin and Greek. So that was the main thing you studied, and what you'd be learning was not only how to read Greek and Latin, but how to compose in those languages. So you would be able to write Latin and Greek yourself imitating the style of the classical authors. And in fact, the first work that Hobbes wrote was a translation of the great Greek historian Thucydides. Now, it's interesting, even though Hobbes was trained as a classical scholar, in the Leviathan, 1651, which is the book where his main book on political theory that we're talking about today, he says it's dangerous to teach the classics because you could get the idea that people should, from studying certain of the classics, people should be able to disobey the state. So even though he was a classicist himself, he thought people really shouldn't study the classics. And if many of you may know Hayek's great book, Road to Serfdom, and he mentions in the footnote, he comments that Hobbes held this view. Obviously, Hayek doesn't think very much of Hobbes for holding that view. So, why did Hobbes, why was he trained in classics? Why did they go in for this classical humanist tradition? Why was Hobbes interested in studying that? Well, Hobbes came from a fairly poor background. And in those days, the society was much more stratified than it is today. If you were born in a certain condition, that's usually how you ended up. But one way, say if people were exceptionally intelligent, you could advance your social position was to be trained in classics, which would also include training in rhetoric, which is the study of persuasion. It also would be include studying persuasion in legal arguments. It's called forensic rhetoric. So what you would learn if you're going to take advanced studies and learn the classical languages, you would learn classical rhetoric and persuasion. Now, what would be the good of that? You know, say you might think, well, if you can write in classical Latin and Greek, well, maybe you could teach other people to who are interested to Latin and Greek, but you might think, well, it's not going to be of much use to you. Unless you're planning to specialize in those languages, why would you want to bother? But what happened at that time, people who were skilled in classics and rhetoric would be very useful to, in service to noblemen who were the ones who were really running England at the time, because they would be able to compose certain types of writing, say in political statements or diplomatic correspondence, and they would be able also to teach the children of the nobility or instruct them in political wisdom as gained from the classics. So if you were trained the way Hobbes was, you would, this was a way you could advance in society because you get a position with a noble family if you were very good, and that person would be your patron and you would be able to be an influential advisor to whoever it was. And Hobbes spent his life serving noble families, especially the Earl of Devonshire and the Earl of Newcastle. Those families later were elevated to dukedoms, but they were at that time earls. And I should mention Quentin Skinner, who's a contemporary historian of political thought, is the leading writer on Hobbes and rhetoric. He's the one who's really stressed how important classical rhetoric was for Hobbes' political views. Murray Rothbard thought very highly of Quentin Skinner as a historian of political thought. Now, to get understand Hobbes' political theory, we have to go a little bit into the background of English history when he was writing. Now, in the 1630s, remember the king was King Charles I, who was the son of James I. Remember, after Queen Elizabeth died in the last of the Tudor dynasty, she died in 1603, so then they had a new dynasty. The Stuarts came in. King James was also the King of Scotland, so he became the new king, and his son was Charles I. So at the time, there was a lot of controversy over the power of the king. The Stuart kings claimed that pretty much the king could really do have absolute power, that they had an extremely high view of kingship. And people in the parliament that, well, they certainly agreed that the king was the ruler. They said there are certain customs and laws of England that limit the king's power. In particular, the king can't impose new taxes without the consent of Parliament. Parliament will have to approve any new taxes. And King Charles didn't agree with that, and he tried to impose new taxes, but the British courts in some cases ruled against him. So King Charles didn't like the fact that Parliament wasn't doing what he wanted. So what he did was, he for many, many years, he just refused to call Parliament. But then eventually he had to do it because he did need money for various military expeditions he wanted. So he had to call Parliament. Big struggles about, and eventually there was a civil war. In 1649 didn't turn out to be a very good year for the king because he was executed. King Charles's forces lost the civil war. He was executed. Not deposed as king, he was executed while still having the title of king, but the parliament said, oh, he violated his coronation oath, so he should be executed. So, remember, Hobbes was a servant of the Earl of Devonshire, and the Earl of Devonshire supported the king, so he wasn't going to do very well after the king was executed. So he went into exile. He left England. But even though Devonshire had left, Hobbes came back to England while Oliver Cromwell, who had become the protector, which became ruler of England after the execution of the king, Hobbes came back while Cromwell was still in power. So this got him into trouble. He'd been previously identified as a royalist, a supporter of the king because of his patronage. But when he came back, some of his royalist friends were very critical and said, oh, you're going over to the enemy. But after the Stuarts came back under Charles II, Hobbes was able to get out of any difficulties, and he kept on going. So Hobbes was first a supporter of the royalists, and then he kind of hedged a little bit by coming back to England under Cromwell, but he wound up on fairly good terms with the royalists. And we'll see when we talk about what he said in Leviathan, that he would pretty much get along with anyone who was able to maintain order in the society. He hated disorder and fighting. The Civil War really upset him. And what he was interested in was, how could a society ensure order so we wouldn't have factions fighting against each other? Now, when Hobbes was a young man, there was a climate of skepticism among European intellectuals. Now, this is in contrast. The earlier Renaissance humanists, who were humanists is someone, doesn't mean a humanist, I don't mean somebody who doesn't believe in God. Sometimes people say, well, I'm a humanist, meaning I'm an atheist. A humanist means someone who studies the classical languages, who studies Latin and Greek the way Hobbes did. So the earlier Renaissance humanists like Thomas More and Erasmus tend to be very idealistic. They would remember Moore's utopia, so they would have pictures of what they thought were ideal societies, and Erasmus was very much writing on how we could have peace among nations and reject struggle, war, and the struggle for power. But after this earlier Renaissance humanist period, people tended to take a more cynical view of politics, and they viewed it as a struggle for power. So the successors of More and Erasmus said, oh, well, let's forget about all these idealistic plans. Let's forget about utopia. Politics is the struggle for power. And one classical writer they stress a lot was the Roman historian Tacitus, who tended to take a very cynical view of political power. He was emphasized when he wrote about the rise of the Emperor Augustus and the overthrow of the Roman Republic. He was picturing this very much as a power struggle. You might look at a book called The Roman Revolution by Sir Ronald Syme, which S-Y-M-E came out in 1939. He wrote very much along the lines of Tacitus. I remember once Syme, I went to a lecture by Syme, who's one of the greatest 20th century historians, and he lectured at UCLA this one afternoon, and he started his lecture by saying, it's so good to be here at Stanford this morning. It's UCLA in the afternoon. So that story stayed with me. But so, as I say though, when Hobbes was studying classics, Tacitus was very influential. People tended to view politics as a struggle for power. And this is, Hobbes took over this attitude. Now, one contemporary writer who influenced Hobbes was someone called Justus Lipsius, not exactly a household name, but Lipsius, Dan, you might know, how do I remember so much? Well, I always say, if I don't remember it, I just make it up as I go along. But so Lipsius was a skeptic about ethical knowledge. Remember, we're talking about Plato and Aristotle. Plato and Aristotle were trying to say, well, what can we deduce from human nature about justice? Remember, Plato. And we talked about Plato, who say, Plato said that justice is an arrangement of the soul by which the reason is ruling over the will and the emotion. He thought this is not just his preference, he said that's really what justice is. And Aristotle had his own view of what you need for eudaimonia or happiness and how what's required for that. So Plato and Aristotle said there's an objective good, there are things out there, there's a sort of, just like there's a matter of fact about what the world is like, there's a matter of fact about what the objective good is. So Lipsius rejected that. He said, no, we really don't, we just have different opinions about what's good. It's not a matter of objective justice knowledge. However, he said, well, we do know one thing. We know that everybody wants to survive. So I guess Lipsius had read some Ayn Rand because she says that, but he didn't accept the part that we have objective knowledge. But he says, well, we all want to survive, but other than that, we just have different views about what's good or bad. And then another writer who influenced Hobbes, the Dutch jurist Hugo Grotius, probably most of you have heard of him. He also stressed that each person wants to survive. So this, as we'll see, is it something very important for Hobbes, that everyone is aiming for his or her own survival. Now, Grotius took this in a way that certainly Ayn Rand would. Of course, you know, in Rand's theory, each person is trying to survive, but Grotius said, well, you can get a justification for slavery in certain circumstances from the fact that everybody wants to survive, because supposing, say, there was a war and one side defeated the other, and they were going to, they captured the people from the other side, so they could say to the people, well, they captured, well, we're going to execute you unless you agree to be slaves, so unless you accept slavery, so since people want to survive, they would accept this. So Grotius thought, well, that's how you could get a justification for slavery under certain circumstances. Now, as I mentioned, this view that you have of Lipsius and Grotius had were, especially Lipsius, where he's saying there isn't an objective truth about good or bad other than survival. This is part of a more general trend of the time to reject Aristotle's views. Now, in Aristotle's view, as I tried to explain when I was lecturing about him last week, we can find out the nature of human beings and also nature of other things. We kind of say, we can ask things like, what is the essence of a plant, or what are the essence of a species? If we can have essential knowledge of it, characteristics of various substances, we can have even a more general science of the nature of being. And how do we get this type of knowledge? How do we find out what the essences of things are? Well, according to Aristotle, we start with common beliefs that people have about the subject we're studying, and we try to think about those and refine these beliefs. So in the early 17th century, philosophers like Descartes said Aristotle is going about things the wrong way, because we can't really trust common beliefs about perception in particular. We're subject to all sorts of perceptual illusions. So we can't say, as Aristotle did with physics, well, we just start with certain observations people have about things. And Aristotle did some biology and physics, and we try to reason from the common beliefs we have. Descartes said, well, we can't really trust our ordinary perception, so Aristotle's method procedures undermined. And Hobbes knew Descartes, didn't know Aristotle, he was old, but not that old, but he corresponded with Descartes, he met him, he didn't really get along with him all that well because they had different views on various things, but he corresponded with him, he also met Galileo once. So what Hobbes was taking over from this view, common view of time, but you can't start with ordinary common beliefs about things you can't really trust the senses, so you're not going to really be able to get, based on common beliefs, you're not going to be able to get the essences of things in the way Aristotle thought you could. So what Hobbes thought, like I said, well, we do know we're perceived, we have various perceptions, like I'm looking, so I'm looking out, I can see things out there, I see kind of colors and shapes of various kinds. But so Hobbes said, well, sure, we see things or we hear things, we get various things coming, or sort of the sensations that are coming into us, but those don't, these sensation perceptions really don't give us any knowledge of objects or the self either. So all we know is, all we can see is that there are various kinds of perceptions, but you can't reason from those perceptions of what objects are like and what the self is like either. I remember there's a famous argument, Descartes didn't agree with that, because Descartes said, well, at least I know that I exist, because look, suppose I doubt that I exist, well, at least I'm doubting, if I'm doubting, well then I have to exist, I can't doubt without existing, so don't I know I exist, I'm thinking, I think, therefore I am. So Hobbes said, well, all right, you can say that, but it isn't really telling you anything. You're just using I as kind of a placeholder for whatever is for having the active thought, but it isn't really giving you any information about anything. It's just kind of saying, well, there are thoughts. It isn't telling you anything. And Hobbes also held space and time are really just imaginary, that just, you can't say space in a sense really exists apart from people's perceptions, or time really exists. So this is about space and time are imaginary, so he's not very much left. Now, for those of you who study Kant, we'll call Kant also held space and time were kind of what he called forms of intuition rather than parts of a new, what he called the noumenal world, which is whatever exists apart from our categories and perceptions. So Hobbes had kind of an anticipation of Kant here, that space and time were imaginary. Now, so Hobbes is sounding pretty skeptical, as you see. And he also holds that language is purely conventional. We don't get the essences of things, that we just attach names to various perceptions that we have, and we can talk about things, that we're just kind of doing this in a purely conventional way. I mean, convention doesn't mean convention means, you sometimes will talk about something as conventional meaning ordinary as opposed to something odd or unconventional. Here, conventional just means in accord with rules that are stipulated. So there's no right or wrong about language, just people get together and attach names to things, and that's how we get language. And because of his skepticism about what perception can tell us, he tends to have a very negative view of experimental knowledge. I was mentioning before the lecture started, I was talking to Danny a little bit about this. And what Hobbes, he didn't, at that time, experimental science was developing, so you had Robert Boyle and other people in the Royal Society, and Hobbes tended to be very critical of experimental knowledge. Say, I think in one of Robert Boyle's experiments, he created a vacuum by a certain method. So Hobbes said, well, how do you know it's, he's pushed various things out of the tube, but how do you know it's nothing there? Why should we think it's a vacuum? In any case, you've just done it through this one tube, why should you think you could get any general laws just from the fact that somebody's done an experiment? This is not an example. Hobbes, I mean, suppose somebody, say, a chemist analyzes water and says that water is H2O. Well, why would you think that if you take some other sample of water, it's also going to be H2O? Hobbes said all that you can get from an experiment is just a particular. So it's a bit like, in a way, it's funny, it's a bit like Mises. Remember, Mises in Human Action criticizes econometrics. He says, well, some writers say they can come up with laws about demand for certain commodities, but all they've done is come up with historical data of what particular quantities of commodity have been demanded in particular. Appears they can't get a general law. So Hobbes is really having a similar criticism of experimental science, that, well, you can do an experiment, but what gives you the right to generalize from it? So he says, well, one thing we do know is that our perceptions are caused by material bodies. So we know we have perceptions, so we know there's something causing these perceptions. We don't know the properties of the material bodies, what's causing our perception. And I say, we don't have any knowledge of objective good. So here he's his view, just like Lipsius. So we can say good and bad are whatever people want or doesn't want. So good, in case, is kind of in a way, just like say with a magnet will attract certain things. So he says, well, good attracts us and bad things repel us. And that's all we can say about what's good or bad. So if I say something is good, I'm not saying there's anything, kind of some objective fact about it, just saying something like I'm attracted to this thing, or I say bad means I'm repelled by it. And now here, again, we'll recognize this from Lipsius and Grotius. He says every person, in fact, every material particle tries to keep itself in being. So each of us is trying to keep living. He calls this tendency to keep going by the Latin word conatus. This is something that Spinoza also has in his philosophy. Everything has it, trying to keep itself in being. Now, what Hobbes does when he has these views on metaphysics and theory of knowledge and ethics, now, what he wants to do is come up with some kind of justification for political authorities. I think what he's very afraid of, is disorder. He didn't really, was horrified by the Civil War in England. He wants to say, well, how could we justify some kind of authority that will keep society together? So the way he proceeds, well, he imagines what he calls a state of nature where there isn't any political authority. He said, well, how could people in this state of nature agree on establishing a political authority? This is the main project he has in Leviathan. So he said, well, imagine you're in a state of nature where there's no sovereign, there's no ruler. So he says, in such a state, every individual has what he calls a right of nature to do whatever is needed for his own survival. So each person wants to survive. Remember, we have this, what Hobbes calls this conatus. In fact, every material particle is trying to keep itself in being. So each individual wants to keep himself or herself in being. So you have the right to do whatever is needed for your own survival. But it doesn't imply you can do whatever you want but you couldn't say, well, I don't like this person, so I think I'll hit him over the head, or, you know, why not? And just following stand your ground. Well, no, you couldn't do that. You have to, only if you thought your own survival depended on it, could you do something to someone else, to attack someone else. And so a lot of people get this wrong. Hobbes did not say that in the state of nature, everyone is hostile to everybody else. And he allowed that people could be friends with other people, could love other people. However, what he did think is that everybody poses a danger to everybody else. And why is that? Well, people don't, there's some people who are, say, much stronger than other people, but no one is so much stronger than somebody else that the other person, the weaker person, couldn't kill him under the right circumstances. So we're all vulnerable to each other. People in the state of nature are fearful of each other because anybody could kill each other. And I see somebody's put in, my survival depends on my nature's new outing. Well, Hobbes wouldn't let you say that, so it isn't what you think you need to survive. So you couldn't say, well, I really like my neighbor's car, so I think I'll just say I need that for my survival. It would just be a matter of fact whether you did need that for your survival. And if you didn't, you couldn't just take it over. So people are fearful of each other, and they're also influenced by pride, which is you want to surpass other people. This is Hobbes thinks this is just a fact about people. People are influenced by pride, and they're fearful of each other, especially afraid of violence. Death, because each person wants to survive. So Hobbes says, well, what we can do is we can deduce laws of nature which are hypothetical imperatives. What's a hypothetical imperative? Well, an imperative is something like telling you to do something like, give me your money. I'm telling you, do this. But a hypothetical imperative is holds under a condition, say, if you want to pass this course, give me your money. So there I'm saying, well, how do you pass the course? You give me your money. So in Hobbes' view, you could have hypothetical imperatives that would say, if you want to survive, then you should do such and such. And remember, Hobbes thinks everybody does want to survive. So these laws of nature would be very important to people. They'll be telling you what you need to do in order to survive. You do want to survive. And he has about 19 laws, but one that's especially important is if you can make an agreement with somebody not to attack each other, suppose I say to you, I won't attack you if you don't attack me, you should do so. And you can see why this would be a law of nature. Hypothetical imperative would tell you what you need to do to survive, because if we have an agreement where we won't attack each other, then I don't have to fear you, because you're not going to kill me and I'm not going to kill you, so we can get along much better then. So you can see if we could make such an agreement, we would want to do it, because that would very much increase our prospects of survival. However, there are problems. Well, one thing is, how would we coordinate all these agreements among people? Say there are a lot of people in the state of nature, and they all want to make an agreement with each other not to attack. I won't attack you if you don't attack me. So I'm making this agreement with everybody else, but wouldn't that be kind of hard to arrange all these agreements? And then there's another problem, which probably worse is, suppose I agree with you, I say I won't attack you if you don't attack me. Let's say I have weapons, I have a gun, battle axe, and other things. So I say, okay, since you're not going to attack me, I'm going to throw away my arms. But once I've done that, then you have all the arms and I don't have anything. So why should you follow the agreement? Maybe you think we'd both be all right if we didn't have any arms, but wouldn't it even be better for you if you had arms but I didn't? Then maybe you could do things to me if you thought you needed to do those in order to survive, but I would be unable to do anything to you. So we wouldn't have any means of assurance. If we each promised that we laid down our arms if the other person did, we'd have no means of ensuring that the other person would lay down his arms if I did. Because once I laid down my arms, then if you still have them, you could really time, but that might be with a lot of people, that would be very difficult to arrange. So Hobbes had, so he said, well, remember the law of nature just says we should make this kind of agreement to be at peace with each other if we can, but now it doesn't seem like we can, so the hypothetical law of nature really doesn't apply. Hobbes has a famous sentence, covenants without the sword are but words. So he's saying, well, you can have an agreement, unless you have some way of enforcing the agreement, it isn't going to be worth anything. And we do want to have such an agreement because we'd all be better, we'd be better off if we're not constantly in fear of one another. Now, there's an interpretation of Hobbes that was held by A. Taylor. Now, do any of you remember, I mentioned A. Taylor in one of the earlier lectures. Does anybody remember who was A. Taylor? Anybody remember A. Taylor? Well, he's one of the great authorities on Plato. He was one of the greatest philosophical historic scholars of the 20th century. And so he was a great Plato scholar, but he also wrote on Hobbes. So Taylor and a later scholar called Howard Warringer have an interpretation of Hobbes that says the laws of nature, these imperatives, they're telling you how to survive in the state of nature, aren't just hypothetical imperatives. According to them, God ordained the laws of nature. So you're not just hypothetical imperatives, they're rules that God has established. However, there's a problem with this interpretation. Hobbes doesn't really say this. When he talks about God, when he speaks of God, he just really talks about that in the Bible, God tells the people of Israel what to do, but Hobbes doesn't really talk about laws that God establishes for everybody. So this Taylor and Warringer interpretation isn't really the one that most people, most scholars hold. But so now we get to the crux of the matter. How does Hobbes get us out of the state of nature? We all have this law of nature saying, well, we should try to make an agreement with other people to lay down your arms if the other person will. But it seems like we can't get the agreement going. So what Hobbes says is, well, let's imagine everybody, you just pick one person, leave him out. And everybody says to everybody else except that one person, I'll surrender my right to deal with any threat to this one person if you do so as well. So instead of saying, I'm going to lay down my arms, if you lay down your arms, I'll say, I'll surrender everything to this one person if you surrender everything to this one person as well. So we're all surrendering our arms to this one person. So then you might think, well, isn't that going to raise a problem? Because that person will have all the arms, so he can then do whatever he wants to us. But what Hobbes thought is, well, if the sovereign starts attacking people or doesn't keep order the way he's supposed to, then people would have no reason to keep their agreement to do what the sovereign said. And in fact, Hobbes says, you really can't surrender to the sovereign your right to deal with direct threats to your own life. So if, say, Hobbes actually gives an example, supposing you're arrested and you're condemned to death by the sovereign, Hobbes thinks you have the right to escape because you can't really give up your right to preserve yourself in being. This is basic thrust of the way human beings are, that each person wants to survive, and that's not something we can give up. Now, there's a problem in Hobbes' view that everybody tries to preserve himself. Aren't there religious martyrs? Aren't there people who say, well, I'd say in the early Christians, there were people who said, they said to them, well, you must agree to bow down to the emperor as a god, or if you don't, we'll kill you. And they said, you know, we're not going to do this. So, and then they were killed. So aren't those people going against what Hobbes says? Hobbes says everybody tries to preserve himself, but those people didn't. And Hobbes really thought that people who act in that way were really fanatics. They were really kind of deluded. They're just it's kind of madness to act in this way. But then he's going to get into a problem because Hobbes professes to be a Christian, as we'll see. There's people who doubt that he was one. But I mean, how can Hobbes say, well, you should try to preserve yourself if it looks like, don't we, Christians, aren't you supposed to admire the martyrs, people who were willing to go to their death in order to keep their faith? But Hobbes appeals to him. Hobbes knew the Bible extremely well, and there's an episode described in the second book of Kings, chapter 5, where there's a Syrian general named Naaman who has leprosy, and the prophet Elisha is able to heal him. He tells him to bathe in the river Jordan 7 times, and he's healed. So Naaman so gratefully converts to the Elisha's God. He said, well, now I know who the true God is because you healed me. But he says to Elisha, I'm going to continue to bow down in the temple of Rimmon, who was the god of the Syrian king. So he said, even though I now believe in the true God, I'm going to do externally what the king requires in order to survive. So Hobbes said, well, that's the way, if you have religious beliefs, that's the way you should act. You should just hold these beliefs inwardly, but obey the sovereign. Now, that it's in the Bible, it's not clear the Bible is endorsing what Naaman said, except that that's what he said to Elisha. Elisha doesn't say anything to like, yeah, that's the right, you've done the right thing, go ahead. But Hobbes took it that way. Now, as I say, Hobbes held you can't give up your right to your own life, even though you've surrendered all your arms to the sovereign. Everybody surrendered to the sovereign, because the sovereign's going to be a keep order. You can't give up your right to your life. But this raises an interesting problem. What about conscription? Suppose a king drafts you into the army. If you're in the army, you could very easily lose your life. Say you're in the army, they send you into battle. Sometimes you have a very good chance of dying, or they might even send you into a situation where you could be pretty sure you would die. So if you have the right to refuse, well, that seems to limit the sovereign. But Hobbes doesn't want to have a limited sovereign, because you're surrendering everything to the sovereign, except sovereign can't directly take your life. But if you can't refuse, isn't Hobbes going to get in trouble? Because then wouldn't you have to put your life at risk? So what Hobbes says here is, well, it's true you have to obey the sovereign, and this could make you risk your life, but that doesn't worsen your position from the state of nature. Because in the state of nature, you would still have to take risks. People might be threatening you, and you'd have to risk your life. So all you've done with the, if you surrender to the sovereign, is you delegated to the sovereign the right to make these decisions about when to risk your life. So he's now your agent. So instead of saying, I'm going to risk my life in responding to attacks in such circumstances, it's now up to the sovereign to just weigh these risks and costs. So he says, you're not really losing anything. I think we can go into this a little more in the discussion. This argument really doesn't work, because what the sovereign is deciding the risks and costs for the whole army, is not interested in the risks and costs for you in particular. So he might be, it isn't just that he, instead of my deciding when I should risk my life and when not, what would be to my advantage, the sovereign might not be considering what's to my good at all. He might just say, well, I'm weighing the risks and costs for preserving my army, but that might involve getting rid of you entirely. So I don't think Hobbes has really solved his problem there. Now, we've got this contract or agreement where everybody surrendered his arms to the sovereign, the same sovereign. Remember, the sovereign is not party to the contract. But so we have the difficulty, so everybody surrenders to the sovereign. But we have a problem here, is how could, which I think is a very interesting theoretical problem, how could this agreement come into force? So all we have is a series of hypotheticals, each person saying, if everybody else will surrender to the sovereign, I will as well. And we should take this to be kind of a series, everybody else, and not everybody else kind of as a collective body. Imagine each person saying to each other person, I'll surrender to the sovereign if you will. And you say that to at least a lot of different people, if not everybody in the site. So you have all sorts of people saying, I'll surrender if you will, I'll surrender if you will. And they're all kind of networked in with each other. So everybody's interested in, everybody's made this agreement, I'll surrender if you will. So the problem is, suppose we have this series of hypotheticals. Has anybody actually made an agreement to surrender anything to the sovereign? An example to bring out from it I like to give is, supposing, imagine a little boy says to his father, may I go to the movies tonight? I want to see they're having a special showing of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I really want to see it. And the father says, yes, you can go if your mother says you can go. And then he goes to his mother, says, can I go to see the movie? And she says, yes, if your father says you can go. So has either of does he have permission to go? Oh, it seemed like all he's got is two hypotheticals. One says, you can go if your father says you can go, and the other one says, you can go if your mother says you can go. But to get permission, somebody would have to say, okay, you can go. So here, if we have all these series of hypotheticals, everybody's saying, I'll surrender my arms to the sovereign. If you surrender your arms to the sovereign, somebody has to actually surrender his arms to the sovereign, and then that activates the agreement. If you have one person doing it, then you could get kind of a whole, everything would follow, because they, I said, I'll surrender, say, if this person surrenders. So I now surrender, and so then, say, this other person is surrender. I say, I surrender if you surrender, now you surrender. Then I have to surrender my arms to the sovereign. But someone else has said to me, I'll surrender if you surrender, and I just surrendered, so then he'll have to surrender too. So if one person agrees, you can get the whole ball rolling. So the question is, could you get one person to start things going by actually surrendering his arms to the sovereign? Would you be stuck with this, all these hypotheticals? And Hobbes says that someone who actually surrenders, well, you would say, well, why wouldn't you? Because what if you surrender to the sovereign, nobody else does? He says, well, that would be all right, because if you do that, nobody follows. You really haven't lost anything, because suppose I surrender my arms to the sovereign, nobody else does. I haven't really committed myself to anything. So Hobbes thinks you could get the whole process started. Now, as I presented the agreement on state of nature, so far I said everybody, there's just one person left out of the agreement. Everybody's surrendering his arms to that person. So that would be a monarchy, because you have one person as a sovereign. And that was the system Hobbes actually preferred, but he didn't think that a sovereign had to be a monarch. You could also have a group of people as a sovereign, or even you could even have a democracy, which would be ruled by a majority. Now, in Hobbes' system, everybody surrendered to the sovereign, so you don't have rights against the sovereign, other than you retain this right. If the sovereign tries to take away your life, you can resist that. But other than that, you don't have rights. So some people think of Hobbes, well, isn't he pretty much a proponent of despotism because he says that? But even though you don't have rights, Hobbes thinks that the sovereign really shouldn't just act and do whatever he wants. He said what he should do is act in a way that preserves peace. That's what he's been put in for, and should act in that way. So Hobbes thinks there are definite ways a sovereign should act. It's just people don't have rights against the sovereign. There's definitely rights, right and wrong ways the sovereign should act. Now, one point that I think would be special interest to libertarians would be, but what does Hobbes say about property? And here we would actually get into the example someone humorously raised, where someone said, I need my neighbor's Audi in order to survive. Well, Hobbes's view was in the state of nature, you have a right to as much property as you need in order to preserve your life, but you don't have a right to more than this. So I can appropriate things I need to live, but I can't just appropriate as much as I want. Now, once the government exists, once the state exists, then it decides on what the property titles are. But Hobbes held the view that once the government establishes these titles, it shouldn't interfere with them. You can see why he would hold that, because he's interested in preserving order if the government starts shifting around property or helping some people at the expense of others is going to promote discord. So what Hobbes said is the government should establish property titles and then leave them there. And although Hobbes thought that poor people should be helped, he rejected redistributive taxation. He didn't think the government should just say, well, we're going to confiscate money from the well-off and give it to the poor. I think he did favor certain limits on how wealthy, but he didn't in general favor redistributive taxation. Now, because he held these views that were largely favorable to property, there's a Marxist interpretation of Hobbes that you'll find in an influential book by the Canadian philosopher, political philosopher and historian of political thought, C.B. McPherson, which is called The Political Theory of Possessive Individuals. It came out in 1962. And he argued that Hobbes was the spokesman of the rising capitalist class. So he said, well, Hobbes is interested in getting your state, kind of powerful state that will protect the property rights of the capitalists. But this view hasn't won general acceptance, and one thing against it is that Hobbes says you have to provide for the poor, so he isn't just interested in promoting what's good for the capitalist class. And then if you take him to be kind of the proponent of the right of the new sort of new system that would be one of capitalist private property, you have to take the state of nature as the medieval system. Of course, the state of nature is not the medieval system, which was one of feudal states. Hobbes has in mind the state of nature is one where people, there's no established order in society. So McPherson's view would go with a theory that Hobbes is saying, how do we establish a capitalist state out of where we are now, which would be where we were before, which is a feudal order, but that isn't what Hobbes is trying to do. Now, one topic also that's very important in Leviathan that I alluded to a little bit before is what Hobbes says about religion. Now, there are some people like Leo Strauss, and remember I mentioned Leo Strauss in the lecture on Plato. Strauss had interpretations of almost all the great political philosophers that are very controversial. He thought that Hobbes was an atheist, that he pretty much said anyone he's writing about was really an atheist. So you pretty much know what Strauss is going to say about people. But some people think that Hobbes was an atheist, but what he actually says, though, of course he doesn't say it that he's an atheist, he says we don't know anything about, really, about God's properties. And it's probably more plausible to say that Hobbes believed in some kind of first cause that was material, because he thought everything is composed of matter, even God is composed of matter. That was the view that the early Christian writer Tertullian held, by the way. So Hobbes thought, well, there's a material first cause of the world that we really can't know anything about what the properties of that cause are, other than that it's composed of matter because everything is. Now, you could say, well, if that's what Hobbes believes, does that make him a virtual atheist? I suppose you say, well, maybe there is some kind of first cause out there, but we don't know anything about it. Would that be something like Herbert Spencer, you know, talks about the unknowable, but that he was really, you could call Spencer an atheist in spite of his saying that. Well, you might think that, but one thing against that is that Hobbes places a great deal of emphasis on interpreting the Bible. And if this isn't in the section of the Leviathan that I put on the reading list, but a great deal of the Leviathan is concerned with biblical interpretation. And you might say, well, how could Hobbes write so much about the Bible if he's so skeptical about perceptual knowledge and doesn't believe in experimental knowledge? Well, he distinguished very much between, starting between knowledge and opinion. He said, well, we believe things on testimony, like say things we read in the Bible, we don't strictly know that we believe them if we accept the testimony, say that we're reading the Bible. And what Hobbes thought was that you count as a Christian if you believe that Jesus is the Messiah. And he took this as kind of in a, as you expect, in a kind of a physical way. The Messiah is Jesus the Messiah, and says he's going to come back to earth and rule over the earth. So if you believe that Jesus is coming back and will rule over the earth, then you count as a Christian. But while we're here, you know, surrender everything to the sovereign has the right to regulate religion. So you can't say something like, well, I'm holding back part of my allegiance because I have certain religious views. No, the sovereign has the right to interpret the Bible and to say what people should do. He's in charge. And Hobbes is very fearful that of intellectuals and theologians with different views of religion. He thought this would set people at odds with each other if you have all these kind of intellectuals with different views about what God wants. This can cause a great deal of trouble. And so the sovereign has to regulate religion to prevent this. And in another book Hobbes wrote called Behemoth, Behemoth, like Leviathan, is this monster describing the Bible. He blames theologians, especially Calvinists, for the Civil War. He said they were stirring people up with all these ideas of promoting disorder, so the state has to stop it. So, okay, so I think we'll, we'll have the rest of the time for the questions, though. I'm going to the Q&A box. You can type your questions in there, and you can also put things in the chat if you want to do that, but I'm going to the Q&A box now. Now, here's one, Roger. What is the process of surrendering your right to sorrow? I imagine that Hobbes would not have proposed that the contract be signed between each person and sovereign. No, I think he, remember, this is just a hypothetical construction. He's just sort of saying something like this. Say we find ourselves now under the rule of the government. So he's thinking, well, you could imagine a state of nature in which you could make such some kind of agreement like this. And by thinking about that, you'll see the actual rule of the sovereign is justified. And he sometimes says, well, if you want an example of state of nature, you could just consider different nations are in a state of nature with each other. Okay, now next one is, Samuel, could you clarify Hobbes' view of property in regards to long-term survival and short-term? How does the idea of money apply? Well, I think Hobbes did think there could be such a thing as money in the same nation, but he didn't really write a lot about that. So he didn't really say all that much about how much property you need in order to survive. But he thought that you had a right of nature to what you did need in order to survive. But I don't think he worked out very developed views on how much that was or what would be, say, when the state establishes property type, exactly what kind of property type those should be. That wasn't his primary interest, but I mean, he did speak of property in the state nature as having a right of nature, but he didn't really write all that much about money. He mentioned it, but he doesn't say all that much about it. Well, wait, there's another question in the chat here. Could you discuss the symbolism of a famous engraving that was in Leviathan? Do you see it on the screen? No, I don't. Well, the picture is kind of a man with a beard wearing a crown, and then you see all these people kind of, or it looks like he's wearing some kind of fishnet. You see all these people who were composed, who were in the net. So it's sort of all the people were kind of joining together to form one body, and this is they're establishing the sovereignty. Remember, in the Bible, the Leviathan is a monster described kind of, it's actually a hippopotamus. So it's a biblical monster. It's kind of a symbol, like a powerful being. Now, if you look at it, there's a book by Carl Schmitt that came out in 1938 on Hobbes, which goes into the symbolism of Leviathan a great deal. That would be one to look at. But you can, it's sort of what he's doing in this picture is kind of representing the process of creation of the sovereign, the sort of people really composing the sovereign. And the next one is, could you please, sir, provide some comments on social agreements and game theory? Do you know of any good work on the subject? Well, you know, there are two very important books by, there's one by David Gautier, G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R, on Hobbes. I forgot the title, but you can just look him up. And there's one also by Jean Hampton, H-A-M-P-T-O-N. She was a student of Gautier. And they discuss very much kind of a game theoretical view of Hobbes, where sort of the idea of the game theoretical view, which is more that Gautier had, is that you say everyone would be better off if everyone surrendered to all his arms of the sovereign. So we'd be better off if we all surrendered to the sovereign than if we all kept our arms individual and we were all in fear of one another. But each person would be better off if everybody else surrendered and I don't. So some people say, well, isn't this just like a standard prisoner's dilemma? Because the prisoner's dilemma, what the course of action that would be best for all of us collectively isn't best for each individual. So I won't go through prison dilemma, the basic idea is for whatever the other person does in prison dilemma, my what makes me better off, regardless of what he does, is not to cooperate with him. And similarly, he's better off, regardless of what I do, not to cooperate with me, but we'd be both better off if we didn't do what was individually best for us. We'd be both better off if we cooperate. Some people say, well, Hobbes is, like Gautier says, Hobbes is really having this idea of a prisoner's dilemma, but it doesn't, there's objections to that. The big objection to taking Hobbes giving a prisoner's dilemma view is that it isn't clear that, say, if I kept my arms, that everybody else surrenders the sovereign, it isn't clear that that would be is the dominant strategy for me. It isn't clear that that would put me in a better position if I just kept all my arms and everybody else is surrendered to the sovereign. So it might not, it probably isn't the straight prisoner's dilemma. It's just, it's more of a problem, it's more of coordination of the agreement rather than getting us out of a prisoner's dilemma. But that, if you look at the book by Gautier and Gene Hampton, their books, that they go into the, Greg Kafka, K-A-V-K-A, also wrote a book on Hobbes and Stress and James Q and Hobbes. I think if we look at those three books, those would be the main authors. You could just get, I'm sorry, I don't remember the title, but if you look at those three authors, you just get them through the author's name, you'll get the books pretty easily. Oh, now here is another question up in the chat. Let me see. Dan says, Leviathan is also holding both his sword and his scepter. Is this a commentary on the unification of church and saying the idea side opposed to conflict between the medieval church and the European monarchs? Well, I think Hobbes did hold the view that both church and state should be unified. See, the scepter isn't a symbol of the church. The scepter is sort of a symbol of royal authority. Of course, the sword means he has the power of the arms. So I think what would probably show in the picture that he's rejecting that sort of divided rule by the church is, remember, he's just one sword in the church's view, you remember, famous with Pope Gelasius, there are two swords. There's the spiritual sword and the sword held by the king. There's only one sword that the figure of Leviathan is holding. I'm sorry, I don't see the picture. There's only one sword, so he's, I think, symbolism there just holding one sword is probably intended to suggest that that's all the sword there is. And the position Hobbes holds on religion is called Erastian, E-R-A-S-T-I-N, after Erastus, and that means that the state should rule the church and the state should decide what the church doctrine is. So the sovereign can interpret it. Remember, Christians hold that Jesus is Christ, who is the Messiah, and the sovereign can interpret that. Now let's see. Here's quite a few others here. Are there any of Hobbes' views in particular still used by contemporary political philosophers to defend the state? Well, I don't think there are too many strict Hobbesians now, but I mean, whereas most influential, I think, is in certain kinds of international relations theory, what's called the realist school of international relations, which holds that nations are seeking power, and Hobbes' ideas are very influential there. They can find, say, in Carl Schmitt, who was a very important German political theorist, who was at least for a period associated with the Nazis. He was very influenced by Hobbes and his view. Now, George says on Aristotle, with another interpretation of the ultimate and for man and happiness, it does this just refer to other interpretations provided. In my understanding, use of reasons man's nature claim as on, so using it with proper external versus make man happy or complete. But then how does virtue fit into the with happiness in a final end? What exactly is the link between these two? Is it just that virtue makes the action of man better and fulfilled the nature and why it's therefore important? Well, I think for Aristotle, virtue is not external to happiness. Part of happiness is acting virtuously. So partly constitutive happiness, acting in the right way. Happiness is not just feelings of certain kinds or getting pleasant sensations. Happiness is leading the life in accord with virtue, and you're right, the external good also required. So virtue is part of the virtuous life, a constituent part of happiness. Wait, here's another question up here. Wait a second. I just lost what I do here. I lost it. Where's the queue in it? Where's the, I just lost the chat. Wait, what I do here? I lost the, oh, here's the chat. Let me go to the chat here. Ah, here we go. Okay. Could you discuss, I did that. Here's one from Bob. According to Hobbes, does the sovereign have a duty to keep the peace, or is it just a nice thing to do? If the sovereign fails, is there any right of revolution, or are the people stuck? Well, Hobbes holds that that's what the sovereign should do. That's what he put in there for. But people don't have rights against the sovereign, because Hobbes thinks a right is something you can enforce. Say, if I have a right to property, then I have a right to my house. That means if you try to take my horse, my house, I can use, force can be used against you. So remember, everybody surrendered arms to the sovereign, so people don't have rights against the sovereign. But nevertheless, he has a duty or obligation to preserve order. So Hobbes doesn't hold the view that obligations are strictly correlated with rights, that this is what the sovereign has to do, but if he doesn't, people can't force him to do it. However, if the sovereign fails to preserve order, then he just stops being the sovereign. I mean, he's not preserving order anymore, so you're not going to do what he says. So his sovereignty would collapse. So if he just fails to preserve order, then the system has come to an end, so you're really not stuck with it. Now, Danny says, was Hobbes influenced by Machiavelli? Well, I think, yes, he certainly was familiar with Machiavelli. And actually, this is a question Leo Strauss was very interested in. He thought they had very similar teachings. I mean, he doesn't discuss Machiavelli that much, but I think he certainly read him. And I mean, of course, they have a lot of similarities, and they're both interested in power. They both were very keen students of Roman history. And you don't have in Hobbes, though, as you do in Machiavelli, the stress that the sovereign can really act in a way counter to ordinary morality. He doesn't. That isn't something he goes into in the same way in the same way that Machiavelli does. Well, I get, wait, oh, and Jason, so when sovereign fails to preserve order, people gain the right of the, well, it isn't a matter of rights, you see, because remember, rights is something you can enforce against them, it's just you don't have any sovereign anymore, it's just, so you're back in the state of nature, it's not you have a right to revolt, it's just the sovereign isn't preserving order, so you're back where you were before you got out of the state of nature, kind of like a collapse of the regime. It isn't a right in the sense you could go to court and say, we have the right to revolt, and it would be. It's just, you're not, if you're revolting, that would suggest the sovereign is still there, so you can't do that, just the sovereign isn't preserving, or you don't have, say, supposing the sovereign is still ruling, that they have a case like what we have in, say, in contemporary Syria, that you have a president, he's still ruling, but people don't like him. So Hobbes would say, well, you can't revolt against him, but if people do revolt against him and he can't put the disorder down, then he's not the sovereign anymore. So it's something like you're supposed to obey the sovereign, but if enough people don't, then he stops being the sovereign. Now, just one question George has on Aristotle. There's another interpretation of Milton and Clement. Well, that isn't another interpretation. That is what Aristotle holds. I mean, it isn't that he thinks the aim is happiness, and there's some other interpretation that says it isn't, but that's what he thinks is the aim, ultimate end. And it's happiness as he explains it. So Jason, so a court who would defend your action to revolt would be a distinctly different sovereign. No, I mean, that wouldn't be a possible situation for Hobbes. There wouldn't be a court that couldn't have competing sovereigns, and there couldn't be a court that would say you have a right to revolt. That wouldn't make sense in the Hobbesian framework. Now somebody says the ruling is handing the election over to Romney on a silver platter. Well, I'm not sure what ruling that is, but all right. Well, all right. Well, I guess that's it then. Thanks very much for coming. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Danny, so next week we don't have class, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, we have off. Now, however, next Friday I'm going to be giving a free lecture, kind of a preview of my course on Atlas Shrugged, so if anybody wants to come to that, I'll be lecturing next Friday. So then 2 weeks from today we'll be having the next lecture in this course, which will be on John Locke. Okay, thanks everybody. Hope to see you next Friday, and also 2 weeks from now on Locke, I Should Live So Long. Thank you.